Patrick.
Oh God. Less.
Yes. Yes.
What was wrong with that?
It's just you're a bit much this morning.
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Right.
It's just. I'm going to get to it. Have you ever lost control? That's the question. Have you ever lost control?
Have I lost control?
Have you ever felt like you get
all right,
to a point?
All right,
yeah.
Right,
okay.
All right. Okay.
Don't tell me to calm down.
I tried to murder my brother.
Did you?
Yeah. Not really though, but I wanted him to think I'd really lost control. So he'd killed my goldfish, all
right? Right.
He'd taken it out, and not only did he kill my goldfish, right? He'd started by flushing all my Star Wars figures down the toilet. This is when we were little, right?
Right.
He flushed everything.
Thanks for elaborating on when you were little.
For the sake of my police statement.
It wasn't last
later.
Week.
No, it wasn't last week, no.
The Match. Because 90 minutes can last a lifetime. Episode 10, 26th of February, 2005. Southampton against Arsenal at St Mary's.
Coming towards the end of February 2005, things were starting to happen for David Prutton. He was in fine form for Southampton, a tough midfielder who was known for his work rate and his tackling, his commitment to any cause. He'd won 25 caps for the England under-21 team, and as a 23-year-old at the top of his game in the Premier League, it's not outlandish to say that a senior cap could have been somewhere near the horizon. And then Southampton played Arsenal at St Mary's Stadium, and in the blink of an eye, something would happen that would change the course of a career. There would be two terrible tackles, a shove on a referee, maniacal behaviour, and then a whole lot of regret. Google the pictures of that mad 2 minutes just to refresh the memory before you listen. And trust me, David is as pleasant and approachable and level-headed a person as you could meet. I'll let David explain, and a brief word of warning. He remembers that day with such clear focus and remembers the effects of it too, and that means that the language gets a little bit X-rated. So if there are young ones around, or if you're of a sensitive disposition, be warned. The story starts, as always, with how David was feeling in the tunnel.
I was very, very pumped up for the game. Not that I was never pumped up for a game, but it come off the back of a game running up to that where it was against West Brom. I had a very good chance, should have scored. Remember, beat myself up for the intervening days. So come game time in the tunnel at St Mary's, it was all very intense from my point of view. I remember speaking to, because my mum and dad had come down, because they were still living in Hull at the time, and obviously I was down in Southampton. They'd come down to watch the game and just spend a bit of time. And a little while afterwards, my dad said, you did seem quite wound up before the game. So being in the tunnel, looking at the players that you're going to be playing against, knowing that deep down you can't touch them skill-wise, but you can do as much as you possibly can to disrupt what they're doing. And the position that we were in at the time, it just the weight and the gravity of the game, I was very, very aware of.
And did you tend to be pumped up before a game? I mean, it doesn't strike me as your character. I appreciate the David Prutton that I know is different from the footballer, but did you tend to be pumped up?
When I was younger, when I got a bit older and kind of probably matured a little bit and got your head around what got you into the best position to be as good as you could possibly on a Saturday was what you did during the week and feeling good about yourself. And then that became a more controlled, responsible way of approaching a football match. But when I was younger, there was a hot-headed side. I mean, the amount of red cards attests to that, and what we're going to discuss does attest to that. But it was always part of, I mean, there's not necessarily screaming and shouting, but there's that macho element of being in the tunnel, knowing that you're not going outside for a tickling contest, are you? You're going outside to physically go up against your opponent. So I said, we're vastly superior to me, so you've got to bridge the gap somehow.
And what do you remember about the game? We're obviously going to get to a certain part of the game and its aftermath as well, so best skip over what happened up to then, I suppose, being honest about it. But what do you remember about the game?
I remember it being fairly tight. I remember, obviously, discussing what we're going to discuss, there was a tackle on, for some reason, Matthew Flamini springs to mind, which in itself was borderline between a yellow and a red. So I'd set my stall out pretty early on of what whatever I was trying to achieve in that game. The emotions were something that I'd pushed to a certain level. Naturally, not that I was there trying to dial them up and dial them down, but felt going into the game and felt as the game was progressing up until what happened.
So you I think you were booked, weren't you?
That was the booking.
Yeah, for the challenge on Flamini.
Yeah. Which, was one of those where you get booked and the referee kind of goes, well, come on, calm yourself down a little bit. And again, latterly in my career, I had a real enjoyment with conversing with referees and building a rapport, which most human beings that are sociopaths hopefully try and do on a daily basis. But in that instant, I probably, it obviously didn't calm me down, did it? It obviously didn't give me what a caution's for, cautioning you to not do it again.
See, what's interesting is sitting in a commentary box being a smart ass, which, as you know, you do it now as well, but I do on a regular basis. The sort of thing you'd say, I think you could see when you look at the footage that you were wound up. You sort of, he's got to calm down here.
Absolutely.
He knows he's a booking away. Is Harry Redknapp thinking of bringing him off? That kind of thing. For people who haven't played, mm-hmm. what's interesting is why you didn't.
Yeah.
You know, because we all presume that, well, he'll calm himself down and he won't, because he knows he'll get sent off if he doesn't sort of sort himself out. But you might have done that for 5 minutes, but you weren't really able to control yourself. Why is that? Because that's interesting.
It is interesting. It suggests that probably how I was at that moment in time wasn't very good at dealing with those emotions. It's weird because being a younger man and growing into a slightly less younger man, you like to think that maybe you hopefully feel things the same way with the intensity and the rawness and the passion of youth, but you filter them in different ways as you get older, don't you? It's like you can't be young and lusty for all your life. You've got to be a certain person to a certain person at a certain point of your life, and it's about dialing down the consequences of those emotions that you feel, which in this instance I didn't. 5 years later I might have seen that as something to address right then and there, and I've got great respect for these players, they're probably more top level players, because they deal with the drama, the emotion, the peripheral white noise, and they can perform. That's what separates the elite from the rest. They deal with the situation a lot better. Their mechanisms for filtering through all that stuff is more finely tuned. So at that moment in time, I was dealing with, still carrying, like, you've had a poor game the game before, so what? You know what I mean? But saying so what without the perspective doesn't help. So it's the relativity of it. It doesn't come into it till later on. So I was there pumped up, and I'm sure there would have been more senior members in the team that would have perhaps said, just pump the brakes a little bit. And even Harry, because I was on that side of the pitch, the predominantly more right-hand side of the pitch, which is where the dugouts are attacking that end at St Mary's. So I'd like to think that there'd have been at least something from the sidelines saying, come on, just drop it down a level or 10.
But what happened next wasn't just the sign of someone who was a bit too keyed up, a bit too keen to prove themselves, a bit too overwrought. It was almost a different level to that entirely, wasn't it? I mean, can you remember? It might sound like a stupid question, but there's a lot of talk when you read about this incident that you said afterwards you couldn't, it was sort of complete red mist and you couldn't remember too much of it. But can you remember it now?
I remember before and after more distinctly now. But
give us before.
Before, it was going in for a challenge with Robert Pires, which was late. I mean, I saw a picture of it on the Monday morning, which was basically me looking mental with my leg straight on his ankle as his ankle was bent over. And kind of seeing it as a bit of an affront that had the audacity to call that a foul, let alone a booking. So that was run up to it. And then it was the linesman that had flagged and started calling Alan Wiley over. So it wasn't, it's funny because the way it's kind of seen is me going after the referee, which it wasn't. It was me trying to go to the linesman whilst Alan stood in the middle of it. I mean, and you say it now, and the comic element of it, you can't come away from, and that's hopefully from the perspective of however many years down the line. So then I've obviously gone across to the linesman to try and make my point, which was didn't exist, and the way that I approached making this non-existent point was just horrendous. Swearing, snarling, everything that perhaps Premier League footballers of a certain era were finger pointed at for, that's disgusting, you can't do that, was absolutely right. You can quite clearly, if, as you said about looking for the footage that for some reason has been wiped from existence, you could quite clearly see what I was saying. And it wasn't, I don't agree with what decision you've made there, Mr. Linesman. So then that's the immediate aftermath. And then you're just aware of bodies. It's thinking, why is there so many people around you? And then you're getting pulled, pictures of Harry Redknapp pulling me away and coaching staff, and then getting bundled off, because there's the two bits of the tunnel. There's a tunnel bit that comes out of St Mary's. There's like a little quick right, then a quick left. Then you're into the main tunnel area, into the dressing rooms. And then kind of dragged in there, and for the life of me, who came and kind of sat me down and just basically, just calm down, you mean it, calm down. And obviously there's the whole kind of cacophony of noise of the stadium. And it wasn't too long before our time, because I remember being sat in the corner. I might have jumped ahead of it a little bit, but I remember being sat in the corner and Harry attempting to do his team talk when half the team's looking over as if to say, what on earth's going on? And again, very vocal and glad you're doing great, apart from one idiot sat in the corner who might have cost you the game. But that'll get sorted out later on. And then obviously the game's the most important thing then. So everyone has a drink, has a wash down, does that, goes back out second half, and then you're then there sat on your own. And that's when you start thinking, oh shit, that's something. The gravity of the situation, the relative gravity of the situation is what starts to kind of drip feed into the way you're thinking about it. And as I said, my mum and dad were there, so Christ knows what they thought of maniac middle child going quite publicly bonkers.
So from the moment when, let's say, the two bits you remember are the way you've described it, going in for a challenge on Robert Pires, and then let's call it roughly bodies, that sort of on the touchline that we've all seen. When did that sort of middle bit start to become clear to you? Did bits of it drip into your brain, or was it literally when you saw it on telly and thought, oh my God, that's what I did?
No, but again, but seeing it on telly, it's, hopefully it doesn't sound like a cop-out, but seeing it on telly, you're looking at someone that you don't particularly, I mean, it's the same silly haircut and skinny face, but it's not the actions and the way that, and not only that, but the energy that you're giving off. You're looking at that going, he's a fucking maniac. That is as raw an example of aggression without me knocking someone out that you could see. And it was that middle bit is, like I said, I'm and as we've spoken in the run up to this and chat about it, consciously, you know, when you consciously push your head into thinking. And still that middle bit is not much clearer than it was when it actually happened. I've lost my temper many times since and many times before. But that, if you sat and thought about that too much, you would think that's a little bit scary that you couldn't remember doing something like that. I'm not saying that, I mean, it's quite a big leap from that to like a proper maniac. But there are elements where you go, Christ, that's quite a scary thought.
I mean, you mentioned that you'd lost your temper before. We all have, you know. But was it quite shocking that that was in you?
Yeah, I suppose it was. I was always a very aggressive player. I always loved the aggressive side of being a footballer, of tackling and dishing it out and taking it as well. That was part of the game. It helped me establish myself in teams where if I'd had to rely on being the playmaker or something daft like that, I wouldn't have got on the team. So you're not saying being aggressive is a strength, but it's something, if you're harnessing the right way, it can make a footballer a decent career. But there was nothing up till then, I don't think, that would suggest that. I was always very emotional about football. I always, again, when I was younger, and it never needed a manager, me or man or anyone to tell me whether I'd played well or not, because I knew. And if I hadn't played well, I was terrible company. Like, mum and dad come see me, I wouldn't talk after the game. I'd go and sit and mope around the house and all ridiculous young man bullshit. But we all go through it and we all hopefully mature from it. But before then, no. And then, and it's obviously something that we'll come on to, but subsequently that changes people's perceptions of you. And also coming even further away from it, when we sit and chat and we discuss games and the kind of relationship that we've developed in football and talking about football, I can see how you can't put the two together. I can see how many people would think the same. Not saying, oh, I'm a great fella now. I never go mental, which is rubbish. But I approach, hopefully, a lot of things with a smile and positive energy. And it's your job as a human being to shine. So, but when you see that, the darkness in someone that's like that, you think, Christ almighty, that's pretty bleak.
Yeah, what is interesting is, as you know, I spend a lot of time with boxers, but I work in boxing and commentate on it. And they're very interesting people because, despite in general being fantastic sportsmen, great people, very good company, a lot of them do have that darkness because you have to, because that's what you do for a living, isn't it? And you do see a sort of, the best way of describing it is a stare into the distance or something that comes across the eyes. No, nothing melodramatic, but I mean, if you get in a ring and do that, that's going to happen. And you do see it in some footballers too. But without wishing to profess to be the best judge of character ever, I've never seen that in you.
Yeah.
And that's why you're right. It is surprising. And when you watch that footage, while being extremely funny, which it is, I mean, it's not for you maybe, but I think it is funny probably to you now, but it is surprising. And it must still, I know you laugh about it, but it must still be something strange for you, I suppose, to look at. I'm sure you don't watch it every night.
Yeah, it's strange. It's every football club that I've ever stepped in subsequently, as that's been the first question from someone in the dressing room when you're in there, and it'd be very naive of me to think that it didn't affect, if we're talking about football as a job, potential employers. They'd look at, oh, such and such, what, that nutter, no chance, black line through the name without even kind of going into it. I've always thought, and the boxing analogy is a good one, because you get the feeling that to get inside a boxing ring and want to be another human being, you've got to play a role, you've got to put on a different hat. I always felt that with football, latterly, it was about whether you had a good, bad or indifferent week, your job on a Saturday was to give off the perception that A, you knew what you were doing, B, you were in control of it, and C, you were doing your utmost to affect the result in a positive way. So you had to play a role. So you might come in thinking, I mean, I might have had a Barney with the missus, or, I mean, something else is getting on my nerves, and it's that cliche of it being a game face. Well, this is what you're paid to do. You've got to come and do it properly. And part of mine was being perhaps that mad bastard in the middle of the pitch that thought my role is to be as energetic, as forceful, as aggressive, which allows the other, perhaps more creative players to go and do their thing.
And you genuinely think that it going too far and being turned up to, quote, Spinal Tap, being turned up to 11... It was about missing the chance the week before. Was anything else going on? Was there a reason you having to prove yourself? Or
there was a bit of that. I mean, from a personal point of view, there was a lot of things that weren't going swimmingly, both on a part of my own behaviour, on the part of other people's behaviour, without trying to sound too vague, which again probably reflects what I said earlier about dealing with emotions as a younger man. There's generations that have been through infinitely different and more difficult situations than what I might be talking about as a man of in his early 20s. But they're little signposts in your emotional life, in your maturity. And the way you deal with, say, a relationship problem now, hopefully is different to what a young 20-something-year-old would do. And also the fact that there'll be different pressures now, there'll be different responsibilities now. So I'd not dealt with that side of it, but maybe not treating myself in the best possible way, because when relationships break down, then you either apportion blame on someone else or yourself or both. And so then when what is meant to be that release becomes a real focal point, the football, the job side of it, then it almost feels like everywhere you turn, there's a pressure or there's a question to answer. And like I said, I say this in full knowledge of relative pressure to other people. Yeah, it's completely different, but it's my own personal experience. And now having the perspective of being slightly older, you can take a bit more out of it, and takes the sting out of the situation. And you are a little bit less harsh on yourself. I think you are, because you look at it and you go, oh, you silly sod. That was a ridiculous time of your life. Well, lots of very fond memories of it. Lots of very fond times with great people. And from a footballer point of view, even moving on to work after football, ex-Premier League footballer, I realise what that stands for. And whether your career is classed as good, bad, indifferent, unremarkable is a word that gets used quite low, which I think is hilarious. I'm not saying it's the smallest select group of men in the world, but not everyone can say they played football in the Premier League, and I'm immensely proud about that, no matter where I thought I either belonged or fit in or in the grand scheme of it. But it shows it was something that I built up to and probably and absolutely did shoot myself in the foot with it for prolonging it in any way, shape or form.
I'll tell you the two things. One is because you're my mate, and two is because I was 23 once. We're going to leave the week before, but I think anyone listening who's been through that knows exactly what you're talking about, or roughly what you're talking about. Of course, not exactly. Afterwards, you talked about Harry Redknapp and the team talk. Mm-hmm. How was he? I can imagine, but I'm going to ask you anyway. Yeah. How was he saved? I mean, when did you see him next?
I saw him after the game, and then it was either the day after the game or the Monday. And he was Harry that you see on the TV is Harry Redknapp. That's how he is. He's got a certain way of doing stuff, which you don't think he'll ever really change from. He's got a lovely way with people. He was lovely with me. Jim Smith was there at the time, and he was lovely with me. And one thing that actually stands out was, so Sky came to the training ground. Basically, it was like, right, let's quickly, hopefully get you on a charm offensive before we get you into the FA, and they get a load of books and just throw them at you. So I've done that, sat there, did a one-on-one. And obviously, grovelingly apologised, and it was all very genuine. I felt terrible. I felt terrible that my mum and dad had seen me in that situation. My mum was in tears and all stuff we wouldn't want. I had plenty of support, a lot of people in and around the club. Well, everyone in and around the club was great, and a lot of people personally still lived up north that got in touch were great. And then I'd done this bit, and I remember being sat in the canteen having just done it, and then obviously it's getting shown on the TV in the canteen, and it's one of those like, Christ, I've just done it, and I'm now watching it back. And Jim Smith said something like patted me on the back, said, "No, absolutely the right thing to do there, you silly sod. You've said sorry, you can't do anything more. Let's just see what happens." And then we went to the hearing at the FA. It was all very like, you get there and the camera's in and watching you go in, and
it's a court case, really, isn't it? Yeah.
And then you went up, and there was, I think there was three fellas that were from like regional FAs. I mean, collective age of, oh God knows, like it was strange. And then Mick Maguire from the PFA was representing me. And Harry was there as a character witness, as my manager, my employer. And he was good as gold. He tried to say his bit for me. And it's funny because I'd not seen Mick Maguire. He subsequently left the PFA, and I think he works in like agency management now for not just footballers, but for film, TV, etc. And I saw him in Club Wembley after the playoff final just a few months back. And he came over, and a big grin on his face. And I was like, not seen you in a while. And he went, it's a bit changed now. I said, yeah, a little bit. And we had a good chat. And but this day that we went in, so he's sat on one side, and he starts, as you put the case for the defence forward, starts off by trying to give it a bit of character background. It starts with the statistics of yellow cards, red cards, for when I turn pro. And you listen to it thinking, wow, that is this helping me or not? Granted, they'd come down, but they'd started at like, my first full season was something like 13 or 14 yellow cards, one red card, or two red, and I was thinking, remember Harry Latterly saying, he was like, Christ, Bryce. He's like, you've got more previous than Reggie crying. Obviously not in front of that, but he said it, and I was thinking, yeah, it did kind of sound like that a bit, didn't it? But Mick's way of doing it was trying to make it out that, like, look, he's getting better. He's addressed these issues that have happened here. This is out of character. And then so did their bit, and they were all very looking on the nose and wagging the fingers. And then it came back with what it was, which I'm trying to think there was obviously the benchmark of the Di Canio thing, because that was the last position that this had been in. That was the kind of, you're thinking, oh, that was quite a long time, that one. So hopefully less than that would be great. but we didn't know where. And then this is what they came back with and said that. And it was a position where I'd left myself completely wide open to whatever they were going to give me. I couldn't appeal it because it just looks, it's like, I'm sorry, but I'm not that sorry that I want 10 games. So then did that, and then I remember Harry running off because he said something about it. Me, it was running out of his car, so he had to do what? So me and Mick had to go downstairs, out the front. He spoke on my behalf, saying, this is what's happened, we'll accept it, he'll learn from it, etc., 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 and just kind of get on with it. And then, that was a 10-game ban with 11 games left, which left you in this weird purgatory where I wanted to, I don't know whether I thought I was going to come back on the last day and save the day. I don't think I was ever that a good enough player to do that. You couldn't hang your season on me. I always thought, Christ, if you're waiting on me to come and save you, then I'd start praying to another God. So then that weird interim period of it being quite a long time where I was training with the first team, I was going to games, for about 3 or 4 days, just perpetually caned in the papers, which, like I said, you leave yourself wide open to that.
Still hard when you're 23, though. You know, you do the interview on Sky, you've been up in front of the beak, for want of a better word, and then you are becoming the poster boy for the ills of football, if you like.
I think, hopefully I've not misremembered this, because it is a very celebrated writer, Jeff Powell, written about the greats, spent time with the greats, hasn't he? But just basically ripped me a new one, saying this absolute clogger who thinks, you know, I mean, what on earth is he doing? Why is he like soiling our game and all this type of stuff? And you think, that's a bit harsh, but there's no way of getting around. And maybe it might have even been different more now, because of you'd get the whole social media side of it where there'd be an onslaught from there, which might have made it twice as difficult or 10 times as difficult to deal with. So thankful probably for small graces, I think, in a way.
I mean, it is extraordinary how, without wanting to put words in your mouth, that, how long is it, 45 seconds, a minute, something like that, then has affected you on many, many different levels. And we'll talk about a couple in a second. But firstly, your career. I mean, you came back, mm-hmm. they were relegated, which isn't your fault, but no. You came back and played in that game in which Southampton were relegated. And then, you know, did you ever really sort of get to those heights again after that? I mean, you when you moved on, as you've already said, there must have been clubs that looked at you and would have had a, you know, turned away or had a second look because of that incident.
And then suddenly you perhaps, not that the fates are conspiring against you at all, but then come back for pre-season, bit between your teeth, ready to go again, and then broke a metatarsal, which on the other side of it, I felt something in training. This was, I think it was around September time, because it was around my birthday. Felt something in training, felt uncomfortable, asked for an injection, a painkiller injection in it. So what was a stress fracture, which I didn't realise, then became a broken metatarsal after running around on it for 65 or so minutes. And another thing, if I remember rightly, who I'd come off for in that game, I'm sure Theo Walcott came on and made his debut. I'm not saying he's got me and my crappy metatarsal to thank for that, I don't know, but that for some reason, that stands out. But so then that sets you back, coming back from that. Within that same season, I tore ankle ligaments, which had me out for... So it's basically 3 months for a metatarsal, 3 months with this ankle, which rehabbed, got back playing fit, didn't really feel great, went to go and have a medical at Leeds, failed the medical, came back, had an operation on said ankle, another 3 months back out again. So that's nearly a year's worth of football there in broken down in different portions that you miss. Coming off the back of that, if I'd not come off the back of that, you kind of think, well, people's abiding memory isn't me going mental, it's me playing a full season, trying to help a team that got relegated. But then it becomes, oh, well, hang on. Is there a question mark over his not emotional stability or mental health, but is there a question mark about his way of approaching games? Is there also a question mark about his fitness levels? Because up till then, I'd never missed a game. I was the one that played through injury. I left Forest at just turning 21 with 150 games under my belt, which, without blowing smoke, it's no mean feat when you turn pro at 18. That's you getting in the team and staying in the team and playing every single game. Good, bad, indifferent, injured, whatever. Not to mention other kind of international games or anything like that. So almost that middle portion, I disrupted my own rhythm from it. And then suddenly you're trying to claw back the reputation that you built up. Because the reputation always was decent, clean living, hard working, ambitious, but gobby at times, but someone that you'd want to have in your team. And I presume those events probably really tugged at that.
Do you ever think about the sliding doors nature then of that match? Do you think about how different things might have been? Because you didn't get injured because of the madness, but it fit into a time frame that didn't help, didn't
absolutely
it?
Absolutely right.
What do you think would have happened if you hadn't lost your head?
I genuinely don't know. I always thought, and I know there is sometimes a recurring theme that you've mentioned before as we've spoken, and even within this chat, chatting with the footballers, that sense of being in a place where you are overwhelmed, but you can't show that you're overwhelmed. Me stood next to a tunnel, next to Patrick Vieira, is in my mind ludicrous, because he's one of the greats. But you're looking at him going, Christ almighty, this is a bit strange. And then the game starts, and you lose yourself in the game, it's fine. But there is always the element of me where Forrest Gump, you see all these famous pictures and he's stood in the background, quizzical look on his face, going, what am I? Have I taken a wrong turn in it? Which is both self-deprecating in a way, but also quite true. So I don't know whether 5 or 10 years in the Premier League would have been my destiny. I know for a fact that running up to moving to Southampton, I was a good player. I could compete at that level. Whether that's reflected in the average standard at the time, because as we know now, it's almost like a different world. But I was confident enough, felt comfortable enough to be able to do that. And if I'd never left to go to Southampton, I might have stayed at Forest for 10 years, never played in the Premier League. Or I might have filtered down the other way. So there is a sliding doors element of being in a position where you set your stall out well enough to be able to get the most out of yourself. But I it is a what if, and when I'm asked about it, any regrets in your career, as much as I think it sounds a bit soppy to say, I say no, because it's, and again, without sounding too airy-fairy, what's meant to be is meant to be, and lucky enough to play there, but there's twin imposters, isn't it, of success and failure. You can't be vested in either of them too much, I don't think. And maybe I can now say this philosophically, because maybe I'm that type of person that wants to look at it philosophically. Maybe in the deep, dark recesses of your mind, you're thinking, bugger, that would have been brilliant to be a Premier League player for a prolonged period of time. And then the other cynical part of me thinks, well, another 10 years on Premier League wages wouldn't have gone amiss, which sounds terrible, but you can't say that wouldn't have been a factor. So my football career is defined by that. And just in recent years, Joey Barton going bonkers, getting sent off. Next thing that flashes up as I'm feeding my little lad his milk, and here are the other people that have gone mental, got sent off. There I am. He didn't know his ass from his elbow then, so I couldn't have gone, there's your dad there. That's what he used to do, go mental at people. And then there was something I was reading the Daily Mail, top 50 notorious Premier League players. I'm in there somewhere as an unremarkable player that went bonkers one day and sealed his place in a list such as that. So it's you've got to see it with some form of humour, whether it's dark or a little bit lighter, I think.
It's interesting that was the final thing, really, the fact that this gets shown. I mean, I think when you started appearing on telly, it was brought up every time, almost as a joke, wasn't it? I mean, but that must get to you a little bit, that you're obviously, you know, without blowing smoke anywhere, an exceptionally good player to play at the level you did, and you made the most of what you had and so on and so forth. Yeah. But almost no matter what you'd done, you'd have been most famous for that clip, which is... You're almost defining yourself at 23.
Yeah, and like you say, 23 is such a young age. There is an element of that. I can honestly say it doesn't really bug me. I mean, we're sat here tonight, was working earlier on today with a man I've never worked with, and that came into the conversation 3 minutes after I've said hello and we've introduced each other. So it's always, from a professional footballer's point of view, it's always going to be there. We've done games where... You can see somebody's about to go bonkers, and I know it's in your head to ask me, and I understand why, and I genuinely smile at the thought, and in any situation like that, you can see it come in, and you also hear yourself talking about it, and you've got to hopefully whoever's bothered about listening to whatever I cover, hopefully they understand the irony of me saying it's got to calm down there, and I do say it with such irony, because you can't get away from it, having slice myself in half by acting like that, then you can't haul people over the coals for it. So it's, and then when you say 23 and being nearly 36 now, you think, Christ, that is a long, long period of time. So it's either that or what particular haircut I had at the time, which gets brought up. And then I've been on Soccer AM, which, I mean, Christ, everyone's been on Soccer AM from a footballing point of view. And the little montage of bits, just to, obviously to jog the viewer's memory, and it went along, and I was sat next to Helen Chamberlain as it rolled through, and part of me sat there thought, I mean, and I was never a prolific goal scorer, you know that I was never a prolific goal scorer, but some of the goals that I scored, I was sat watching it as someone that didn't know the fellow that was playing football. I thought, Christ, some decent goals there. And I said to Helen, I said, some alright goals there, are they? She went, you know the yours. I said, yeah, I know the mine, but it's weird for me to look at it objectively. So there is a part of me that will never go away, but the overriding thought is being immensely proud of being able to say I was a professional footballer, because that's all I ever wanted to do. That's all I ever... Nothing was a sacrifice when I was a kid. It was always a choice. I was never pushed. I was never told, this is what you need to do. I loved kicking around 25-a-side with all the kids on the 10-foot round the back. the cliche, play until it's dust, you can't see the ball anymore, you're getting called in, 10 more minutes, Dad, 5 more minutes, Mum, all that type of stuff. And being able to do that, being in places where people on rare occasions would sing your name, I defy anyone with a heart not to find that both awe-inspiring and really pretty fucking cool, to be honest. But also it being being a footballer. And at the late 90s and into the noughties, that perception of what a footballer was, as we well know, changed slightly with the birth of social media and the emphasis on them becoming moral barometers and all this type of stuff. And there was a point where almost being a footballer was, it almost made people, oh God, what footballer? It almost made it, because there was a perception of how footballers was. But getting up every day, going training, being able to say that I played Sheffield Wednesday at Leeds, at Nottingham Forest, Southampton, and also the addendums of Colchester and Scunthorpe. The other places that make up what football is to probably the vast majority of people, trudging up on a Saturday and walking home with your tail between your legs, thinking a bunch of useless whatevers and I'm not doing that again, and then doing the same thing next Saturday. I've been able to tick off quite a few of the boxes on the footballing spectrum of things that you can experience, and had I not gone mental, I might not have had that other side of it.
As you know, because I primed you for this, I was going to ask you in this whether, to coin a phrase, when you were a footballer, were you a bit of a dick? But you've made such a good case for the defence that I'm not going to. But I'd just like to, because you've mentioned it, and I think people would be interested to know, the final thing about the day and the final thing I'm going to ask you, when you did see your mum and dad for the first time on the day, what did they say? Your mum's obviously in tears, but what did your dad say to you? Because that strikes me as an important relationship at that point.
He was very, they were both, as they've always been from the minute I was born, very tactile. They saw, as they'd always seen in me, how I felt about myself at that moment in time, which as a parent, having kids myself, must be absolutely horrendous. I want you to feel better, but I know I can't make you feel better until you feel better about yourself. That's exactly the position it was in. So they saw me sat down, head in my hands, and my mum's upset, my dad's consoling both my mum and me, and me not saying a word and staring off into the distance. So I knew I wasn't going to get a bollocking off him. Completely knew that, because no matter where I was, what I'd done, any facet of my life that me and my parents have spoken about, and there is that dynamic of father-son, and walking familiar paths. Not that there's ever been a professional footballer that tried to snap Robert Perez's leg in two, but of making mistakes and being accountable for those mistakes. And he knew that I'd take it square on because of the way that they brought me up. There was no hiding place from it. And they just made it known that they would be there always and for what I ever needed, whether it was somebody being there with me or whether it was leaving me alone or being on the end of a phone or whatever. And I think it's funny. I mean, I know you said you weren't going to ask me the question about that, but about how maybe I was as a person at that certain time. But maybe there was an element of that. I was living away from home. I'd gone down in a relationship. Then I was not in a relationship. I was lovely big house by myself. I had friends staying with me, and we enjoyed all aspects of what playing football and being a professional footballer was all about. And mates that I still lean upon to this day, but we give it a good crack in hopefully the most professional sense. And there was elements where perhaps speaking to my mum and dad and them thinking that I was not only literally miles away, but figuratively miles away from what was quite a nice little bubble at Forest and moving into the big wide world of that high level of sport. So maybe there wasn't that arrogance of you thinking that, oh, I'm all right, I'll do things myself, I'm absolutely fine. When you don't, you need your family around you, you need to daft things, you need to get back to your dad when he texts you, you need to answer his phone calls. I mean, don't leave it 3 or 4 days. Yes, I'm fine, Dad, everything's all right. Yes, Mum, it's okay. Not, oh, sorry, right, I'll get back to him, which is bollocks, you know what I mean? They're actively asking how you are. So just grow up and realise that it's as much for them as it is for you, and don't be so selfish about that type of thing. So there is elements of that. And then knowing that I had the support and the support of everyone around me meant that as a person, hopefully, maybe not as a professional footballer, you came out in a better place, but as a person, hopefully, it stood you in better stead for that. Because, Christ, if you don't learn from it and if you can't smile at things that don't actively kill you, then you're buggered, basically.
would be wrong to say that David's career went downhill from that day, but it never hit the heights that it ought to have done. He ended up back at Nottingham Forest, then Leeds and Colchester and Swindon and Sheffield Wednesday before injury finished him. He was smart enough, I think, to know that it was time. It took a lot for him to talk about that day, and he knows how much I appreciate that. He's one of the best pundits around these days and adds intelligence and wit to his knowledge while never taking himself or indeed his sport too seriously. I sometimes wonder whether he used up all of his bad karma in 2 minutes in 2005, and now there's nothing but good. That's it from The Match, and thanks to all of you who've been so supportive and encouraging, appreciating the chance to hear stories that aren't often told and the mindset of people who are right at the core of football. Every match has a story, and I hope that we've made that point. If you're interested in hearing more, if you have a story to tell, if you're interested in backing this notion that there's more to football than instant comment, banter and braggadocio, then do get in touch. You can email me at dave@speechlessmedia.co.uk and we'll see if we can make something happen. Before we go, I must thank not just Matt Vine, Steve Tebb and Ollie Neen, as I do every week, but Danny Garlick, Alice Airy and Emma Roberts, along with Phil Brown, not that one, Dave Rowe, Ben Littleton, and of course my old friend, the richly talented and simply brilliant Patrick Myers, who agreed to rekindle a double act that had been dormant for 25 years, that had previously featured in hospitals and schools, theatres and clubs, and on one badly booked occasion, a lunatic asylum in South London. That fairly brutal grounding led to me talking about football and him performing and writing songs, like the one that has underpinned the show every week. Thanks, Patrick. No more questions for now. And from The Match, bye-bye.
Stop and mourn. I dreamed you'd gone. Woke and saw you and cradled your head. Thought of a million things and more that I could say to you instead. We passed the time, dear, and I cradled your head. I like to keep things simple. I hate to get too solemn. If I say that people kill for what we got in common, would it be too ungrateful to say it's just not enough for us to remain? Last night.